Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Thursday, March 21st, 2024. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, police support grows for regulating traffic cameras. This story by Tom Barton. Cedar Rapids Police Chief joined other law enforcement officials in the state in advocating support for proposed legislation working its way through the House and Senate to regulate, but not ban, the use of automated traffic enforcement cameras across the state. A House subcommittee Wednesday advanced a bill that would require Iowa cities to obtain approval from the Iowa Department of Transportation for the placement of speed cameras along interstates and highways. The DOT rolled out a policy a decade ago in 2014, but the Iowa Supreme Court ruled the agency lacked the legal authority to regulate traffic cameras. The cities of Des Moines, Muscatine, and Cedar Rapids filed lawsuits in 2015, successfully challenging the DOT rules that prohibited cities from placing the systems on highways and interstates. The DOT had ordered some of those cameras turned off in 2015, sparking the lawsuit. Cedar Rapids Police Chief David Dostal joined police chiefs from Des Moines and Altoona on Wednesday in support of measures in the House and Senate to preserve, regulate, and standardize automated traffic enforcement across the state as an alternative to a separate effort that would ban their use. Cedar Rapids uses the cameras at 9 locations along its primary highway system and major thoroughfares for both speed and red light enforcement, including 4 speed cameras around the S-curve on Interstate 380 near downtown. Dostal told lawmakers the cameras have resulted in a significant reduction in serious injury crashes over the past 3 years. There is a change in traffic behavior resulting in traffic safety, Dostal said. Lawmakers have attempted several times over the years to prohibit or regulate use of the devices, citing concerns over their growing use, including in smaller communities, and that they're principally being used to generate revenue because of lack of funding. The devices capture video of vehicles speeding or running red lights. Law enforcement then reviews the images captured by a camera vendor and issues citations to the vehicle's registered owner. House Study Bill 740 advanced out of a 3-member subcommittee Wednesday with unanimous support. It moves next to the House Ways and Means Committee. Cities, including Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, and Davenport, see the cameras as traffic safety tools that reduce public safety costs, providing 24/7 traffic monitoring and enforcement at a significantly lower cost than deploying officers to those areas. That frees cities to focus strained resources elsewhere. Cedar Rapids began using automated traffic enforcement in 2010. Speeding citations are issued for vehicles that exceed the posted speed limit by 12 miles per hour or more. Revenue from traffic citations issued for violations captured by cameras often go to fund police departments. Cedar Rapids anticipates the cameras will generate $7.2 million in revenue for the fiscal year beginning July 1 and ending June 30, 2025. Roughly $5.5 million of that funds 41 police officer positions. More than $1.7 million is earmarked for the city's traffic camera service provider and collection costs. Cedar Rapids partners with Census GATSO USA to run the program. For red light citation, Census GATSO receives $22 per paid citation, and the city receives $78. For speed citations, the vendor receives $18 per paid citation, and the amount to the city varies depending on the amount of the fine. Dostal and law enforcement officials said they're willing to put guardrails on the use of traffic cameras to make sure that they're used as intended for safety purposes and support a regulatory structure that creates a reliable, standardized process. I appreciate having this conversation about a regulatory bill. It's long overdue, Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert said. There are jurisdictions out there that are doing it the right way, some that are not. But all the things I see in this bill on the regulation side are things that we're already doing, things we've been doing since the inception. The bill codifies the previously adopted 2014 DOT rules. Cameras would only be allowed in areas with documented high crash or high risk locations that make it unsafe for police to make in-person traffic stops, such as the I-380 S-curve. Cities and counties would be required to apply to the Iowa DOT for permission to install a speed camera on a state highway or interstate and justify the location with data showing a high volume of crashes, as well as documentation of alternative solutions tried and considered but not implemented, including engineering and design changes and public education campaigns. The bill applies only to cameras used by local jurisdictions to monitor and enforce excessive speed violations on DOT-maintained primary road systems. The Iowa DOT would not have authority to regulate traffic cameras that issue tickets for vehicles caught speeding or running red lights on city streets. It also would prohibit the DOT from using automated traffic enforcement or receiving related payments from cities and counties. Cities and counties could appeal the DOT denial of a traffic camera location and would be required to report back to the DOT annually on the number of citations issued and any change in crash volume to justify the continued use for a camera at approved sites. The bill requires stationary cameras be calibrated quarterly and mobile systems calibrated before each use at a new location. Cities and counties also would be required to post signs in advance of locations where traffic cameras are in use to alert drivers. It also states automated traffic enforcement cameras must be used in conjunction with conventional law enforcement methods, not as a replacement for law enforcement officer contact. Wingert suggested House lawmakers amend the bill to standardize fines across the state so that Iowa drivers know what to expect. Altoona Police Chief Greg Stallman, representing the Iowa Police Chiefs Association, also suggested including red light cameras, which are not addressed in the bill, and requiring a public information and education program to take place before cameras are used to issue warnings. Subcommittee Chairman Representative Phil Thompson of Boone said he's open to amending the bill to include these solutions and suggestions. The Senate has advanced its own bill to regulate the use of traffic cameras. Unlike Senate File 2408, the House bill does not specify how local governments must handle revenues from traffic tickets. The Senate bill would require communities to give up a share of revenues to the state for law enforcement training and an award program for volunteer firefighters and emergency medical personnel. Revenues kept by cities and counties could only be used to pay for road projects or to offset police or fire department operating costs. The Senate bill also would ban traffic cameras for communities under 20,000 in population and specifies how fines could be issued by larger communities. I fully expect us to marry language between the House and the Senate on a regulatory piece and move that forward, Thompson said. Both chambers also introduced legislation this year that combined a traffic camera ban with another controversial bill that would ban the use of handheld phones or other devices behind the wheel. Senate File 2337 is on unfinished business in the Senate. A similar House bill failed to advance. I really think there is a middle ground here, Thompson said. I totally understand the perspective of people who want an all-out ban. I'm honestly, philosophically, probably in that camp. But working with police chiefs, especially in the Cedar Rapids area, these can play a good role in public safety. So I think we're really striking a good middle ground here as far as making sure that it is about public safety and not about revenue generation. Senator Mike Klimisch of Spillville, the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, who proposed the Senate regulation bill, said he intends to sit down with House lawmakers in the coming days to hammer out compromise language. I've always been pro-regulation and look forward to continue to work on that as it moves forward and see what kind of compromise we can come up with, Klimisch said. Also on the front page today, this story, UIHC seeks new leader for Mercy merger. This story is by Vanessa Miller. 3 months after hiring a leader for its complex integration with Mercy Iowa City, University of Iowa Healthcare this week announced she has accepted another job and will be leaving in May, compelling UIHC to initiate a search for a permanent chief administrator of its new downtown campus. Deborah Barini, former president of Penn State Health's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, in December signed a one-year agreement to serve as UIHC Chief Integration Officer and Interim Chief Administrative Officer of the former Mercy Iowa City campus, which UIHC has rebranded its downtown campus after buying it in a bankruptcy auction for $28 million in November. Had Barini stayed with UIHC through the agreement's duration of January 1, 2025, she would have earned $780,000 on the year. Given her last day with the university will be May 10, Barini, at a monthly rate of $65,000, will have earned more than $260,000 over her four-plus months, helping to bring into the UIHC system about 1,000 former Mercy employees, and 192 beds housed in facilities just 2 miles east of the main UIHC campus. Barini's contract with the UIHC allowed her to terminate the deal after May 1, so long as she gave 30 days' notice. In announcing her departure, UIHC reported Barini has accepted a job as president of SSM Health's DePaul Hospital in St. Louis. SSM Health calls itself one of the largest integrated health systems in the nation, with 23 hospitals, more than 40,000 employees, and more than 163,411 inpatient admissions annually. DePaul Hospital St. Louis is a 523-bed general acute care hospital. With UIHC's new 194 beds from the former Mercy site, plus the additional employees, it boasts 1,083 inpatient beds and nearly 20,000 employees. Those numbers will grow once UIHC opens its new $525.6 million, 469,000-square-foot hospital campus in North Liberty next year, providing another 36 inpatient beds. Additionally, UIHC is planning a new $1 billion inpatient tower on its main Iowa City campus, featuring multiple floors of 48 beds each. With Barini's departure, UIHC is launching a search for a permanent chief administrative officer of its downtown campus, which has maintained Mercy's patient services during the transition. We need an interim leader to help provide a smooth transition for employees, providers, and patients, UI Hospitals and Clinics Chief Operating Officer Emily Blomberg said in a Q&A published this week. Now that UIHC has successfully maintained patient care and services through the transition, Blomberg said, we see a permanent Chief Administrative Office for the downtown campus playing an important role in leading future phases. As for UIHC's long-term vision for the former Mercy site, Blomberg and CEO Brad Hawes said that's evolving. We're still in an exploratory phase when it comes to planning for downtown, Blomberg said. Part of that is because, Hawes said, adding the downtown campus to our system was not part of the strategic plan. The opportunity arose, he said, and UIHC was glad to be able to maintain patient access and jobs. We are very much in an exploratory phase where every aspect of the downtown campus is being examined, he said. There are many things to be determined for the future, but right now we're listening and we're learning. In Hawes' recent Q&A published by UI Healthcare, he stressed a normal time frame for absorbing another hospital is years, not months. We accomplished this in about 60 working days, he said, so we still have a lot of work to do as a team to set our strategic goals and vision as a system. in addition to the heavy lift of moving Mercy into Epic, which is UIHC's electronic medical record provider, the university is conducting an extensive evaluation of everything from capacity needs to equipment to staffing, systems, processes, and more. Using a full facilities and equipment assessment to guide decisions and priorities for the downtown campus and clinics from a structural standpoint, Hawes said teams are assessing each property to better understand what needs fixing and what's in good condition. The team is also assessing the spaces from a capacity planning perspective to understand what possibilities exist. Although UIHC didn't give a specific timeline regarding its search for a new downtown campus leader, Blumberg said the job will be posted soon. "We would like to fill the position with a permanent leader as soon as possible," a UIHC spokeswoman said in response to the Gazette's question about whether another interim might be necessary. That search comes as UIHC engages in a separate nationwide hunt for a new chief administrative officer atop its Stead Family Children's Hospital. The university posted that job February 29 to replace Pamela Johnson Carlson, who left more than a year ago in January 2023, to become chief nursing officer at Children's Hospital and Medical Center in Omaha, Nebraska. Johnson Carlson, making $426,703, joined UI Healthcare in April of 2020, and in December of that year added on to her responsibilities for a stint those of interim chief nurse executive. Since her departure, Melissa Whistler has been serving as interim chief administrative officer of the Children's Hospital and will continue in that capacity until a permanent hire comes in. Turning to some Iowa Today news, one dead after Tuesday fire in southwest Cedar Rapids, this by Emily Anderson. One person has died after being removed from a burning house Tuesday by Cedar Rapids firefighters and taken to the hospital. Frederick Slagenwaite, 78, died Tuesday at the hospital. He was removed from his home in the 1200 block of N Street Southwest on Tuesday morning, along with another man who was recovering from non-life-threatening injuries, according to a Wednesday release from the Cedar Rapids Fire Department. Firefighters were dispatched to the scene at 10:07 a.m. Tuesday for a report of a fire. Cedar Rapids police officers had removed one of the men from the home before firefighters arrived on scene. The other was found by firefighters who entered the building to search while extinguishing the fire. Two police officers involved in the rescue were treated at a hospital and released on Tuesday. The cause of the fire still is under investigation. And this story by Marissa Payne. Emerson proposes redeveloping Cedar Rapids' former Ambrose building. Developer Steve Emerson is proposing to repurpose the old Ambrose Recreation Center site and transforming it into multifamily housing, possibly leveraging federal disaster recovery funds and potentially answering the city's long-faltering calls to transform the facility. Emerson's plan includes demolishing the vacant brick building at 2000 Mount Vernon Road Southeast. In response to the City of Cedar Rapids' fourth request for proposals to redevelop the building, Emerson is proposing to shift federal community development block grant disaster recovery funds to this site instead of the initially proposed location at 520 E Avenue Northwest. Last year, Emerson was awarded $4.75 million to build 50 multifamily rental units, 26 of them affordable housing, using federal funds awarded by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to the Iowa Economic Development Authority to aid in recovery from the 2020 derecho. The E Avenue Northwest location is by railroad tracks. It's in a floodplain, Emerson told the Gazette, but would have gained protection from a flood wall that's part of Cedar Rapids' permanent $750 million flood control system. "It's got some environmental issues," Emerson said. With the majority of units being affordable housing, he said, it felt a little hard to put it there without seeming like you were putting housing in a bad location. The Mount Vernon site, he said, is big enough for 50 housing units, but not for additional mixed-use or commercial development. Whether Emerson's proposal for the Ambrose site advances, or he has to go back to the drawing board, any project receiving CDBG funds would be subject to state approval. Community Development Director Jennifer Pratt said city staffers will be working with the review committee to assess proposals and environmental review for the Ambrose site in the coming weeks. That panel will make a recommendation to City Council, which has the final say on any project that takes shape. The approximately 18,700 square foot building has been closed since 2016 when the City Parks and Recreation Department moved to the new Northwest Recreation Center, 1340 11th Street Northwest. Before that, it was the Buchanan School from 1903 to 1973. With the E Avenue Northwest location, Emerson's team had committed to keeping the units in proximity to trails, parks, and bus routes. He said an initial analysis of the Ambrose site suggests it could offer the same proximity. "I think it'd be a great fit," Emerson said. "It's a lot of housing that's really needed in Cedar Rapids." Emerson's block grant award was part of approximately $8.8 million allocated to Cedar Rapids for multifamily housing construction, which will add 94 multifamily units, 48 of them affordable. High Development Corp. was awarded funds to build 40 units, 21 of which are affordable, at 8600 Prairie View Lane Southwest. Charlie Nichols JPAC Investments will build 4 units, 3 of which are affordable, at 710 and 712 O Avenue Northwest, previously a city-owned lot. The city also received about $2.5 million toward owner-occupied rehabilitation, $3.5 million for a tree canopy replanting program, and $400,000 for a generator program for nonprofits, shelters, hospitals, or other critical entities that would remain open during a disaster. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from Tuesday's Chicago Tribune, in the title, U.S. Can't Cruise Through Haiti Crisis. Tens of thousands of Americans visit Haiti every year, despite that nation descending into gang-fueled anarchistic chaos. They just don't really know they are there. That's because they're hermetically sealed off in a place called Labadee, a so-called private destination of the Royal Caribbean Group, located on Haiti's northern coast. In those fun 260 acres, cruisers on ships sailed by such brands as Royal Caribbean and Celebrity can graze the buffet, drink a fruity cocktail or two, and play water sports, with the cruise line snagging most of any additional spending. Labadee first was developed in the 1980s, and the company immediately preferred to refer to its location as Hispaniola, the name for the island divided between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Late last week, though, the company announced it was suspending all its ships' visits to Labadee in an abundance of caution. The troubles in Haiti proper, where armed gangs have been causing havoc in what in recent weeks has become a dangerously rudderless country, have exceeded the cruise line's capacity for risk, despite the security barriers and the intentional separation. That would certainly seem like a wise idea. But for anyone looking at the long, painful history of this impoverished nation, there is irony to spare in the Labadee situation, an attempt to bring the country's natural beauty to market without becoming involved in what clearly now is a crisis that may well produce many more refugees headed to the U.S. for their own safety. Going forward, it's clear that the U.S. can't just sunbathe in isolation. It will have to face up to what is going on in a proximate gang-dominated nation where reports are emerging of widespread killings, kidnappings, and sexual violence. On Friday, U.S. Agency for International Development Chief Samantha Power announced an additional $25 million in humanitarian assistance. That will surely be welcome, but the people of Haiti seeking some semblance of stability as they remain terrified by the men with guns marauding down the streets of Port-au-Prince, remain in search of the systemic international help needed to keep them safe. Again, that is a reprint from the Chicago Tribune. The guest column today by Bruce Lear, Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Year for AEAs. There's a beloved children's book titled Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Alexander wakes up with gum in his hair, and it gets worse from there. After the January 9 condition of the state speech, Iowa's area education agencies woke up with gum in their hair, and it became a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad year. Before that speech, there were only hints that Governor Kim Reynolds wanted to fix the AEA structure and centralize power with the Iowa Department of Education. Before the speech, she announced there needed to be a comprehensive study of AEA. Only days after the speech, the comprehensive study morphed into a full-blown proposal by the legislature dismantling the AEAs with no comprehensive study. Her proposal was met with strong resistance from educators, parents, and community leaders. Because of the opposition and because many Republican legislators had children and grandchildren helped by AEA services, the House bill was amended and then stalled in the Education Committee. But eventually, as Reynolds twisted arms, it passed, but with major changes. Republicans have the trifecta of power, but sometimes it doesn't appear like it. The Senate didn't agree with the House version, and so the bill lay dormant for weeks. On Monday, the Senate passed and amended House File 2612-28-22 with six Republicans joining Democrats in opposition. It's still a gum-in-the-hair bill. The idea of contracting services with private companies for special education services is unresolved because that's not in the House version. Also unresolved is teacher pay. The House passed a standalone pay increase with a $50,000 minimum salary, and the Senate's bill has a minimum salary of $47,500 still in the AEA bill. AEAs have been delivering quality services to schools for 50 years. Their work is often invisible to everyone except the parents of special education students and to educators. If changes are needed, it would truly take comprehensive study with teachers, parents, and administrators as decision makers. Both versions of the AEA bill are flawed. But the version passed by the Senate will cripple rural schools. Private vendors will go to where the money is. That's not rural Iowa. If these vendors even exist, they'll want to be in cities and suburbs. Rural schools will be left with diminished AEA services after private vendors cherry-pick the more lucrative urban and suburban schools. What happens when the for-profit vendors decide they're not making enough profit and raise the rates beyond the funding? Schools will have to make regular education cuts or switch back to the AEA with no consistency for students who need it the most. If Republicans want to push veteran teachers to the exits, they'll only pass a minimum salary bill. Beginning teachers will earn more than those who have taught for years in some districts. As Alexander realized, everyone has bad days, but they can get better. It's up to the Republican legislators to make that happen for the AEAs. And that is submitted by Bruce Lear, who lives in Sioux City, taught in public schools for 11 years, and represented educators as an Iowa State Education Association regional director for 27 years until retiring. We have one community letter today, and it's titled, Did You Miss Pay Gap Day? In 2024, the average woman worked until March 12 to earn the same amount as the average white man earned in 2023. Women are paid less than men at every education level. The average hourly wages by gender and education level for last year are as follows. For less than high school, $19.03 for men, $15.13 for women. For high school, $25.21 for men, $19.84 for women. With some college, $29.51 for men, $22.83 for women, and with a college education, $50.37 for men, $36.85 for women. For an advanced degree, $64.49 for men and $48.21 for women. For more on this data, see the Economic Policy Institute's State of Working America Data Library. Call and make your support known for the Paycheck Fairness Act. You can reach Senator Joni Ernst at 202-224-3254. Senator Chuck Grassley, 202-224-3744. And U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson at 202-225-2911. Their excuse is to say that legislation will not help close the gap, but they neglect to say that this legislation also establishes the National Equal Pay Enforcement Task Force to address compliance, public education, and enforcement of equal pay laws. It will add teeth to the 1983 Act that has helped to narrow the gap. That letter today is signed by Mary Hoffman of Decorah. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, March 21, 2024, on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituary section, beginning with the short notices. First, in Brooklyn, Marvin A. Goodrich, 76, died Tuesday, March 19, Gloucester Funeral Home. In Fairfax, Raymond C. Stark, 82, died Wednesday, March 20, Papich Kuba Funeral Service, Cedar Rapids. From Manchester, Wilbur R., known as Bill Schrader, 87, died Tuesday, March 19, Morris Funeral Home, Guttenberg. In Maquoketa, two notices, Nancy L. Moore, age 68, died Tuesday, March 19, Carson Celebration of Life Center, and LaDonna Shanahan, 75, of Bettendorf and formerly of Maquoketa, died Monday, March 18, Carson Celebration of Life Center. In Marion, Barbara Joan Moss, age 70, died Tuesday, March 19, Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service. In McGregor, Eunice LaVeya Carlson, 95, died Monday, March 18, Thornburg Graw Funeral Home and Cremation Service. From Montour, Bobby Clifford Mason, age 84, died Tuesday, March 19, Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. In Norway, Kelly Ludke, age 59, died Tuesday, March 19, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. In Olmine, Helen L. Warnke, age 103, died Tuesday, March 19, Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home. In Springville, Julie Ann Mann, 66, of Marengo, formerly of Springville, died Wednesday, March 20, Cluster Funeral Home, Marengo. And in Williamsburg, Cody Lewis Casanova, 31, died Sunday, March 17, Powell Funeral Home. Turning now to the regular notices, beginning in Iowa City, Donna Ray Jensen, age 92, longtime resident of Brown Street in Iowa City, died Friday, March 15, at Lantern Park Nursing Care Center under hospice care for heart disease. Private family services with burial at Memory Gardens Cemetery will be held. For a complete obituary, to share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit gayandchia.com. In Cedar Rapids, Joanne Marie Tubbs, age 83, of Suttons Bay, Michigan, passed away Friday, March 8, at Munson Medical Center. Joanne was born August 29, 1940, in Iowa City, the daughter of Hubert and Mildred Spicer Stevens. Cremation has taken place and private family services will be held at a later date. Please share condolences with the family at www.martinson.info. Arrangements are with the Martinson Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Leelanau, Michigan. From Springfield, Missouri, Richard, known as Rick Craig Lund. It's with overwhelming heartache and grief to share that Rick, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away unexpectedly at home on Thanksgiving Day, November 23, 2023, with his wife, Treva, by his side. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, March 30, from 10 to 11 a.m., followed by a memorial service at Herman H. Lohmeyer Funeral Home in Springfield, Missouri. To cherish his memory are his wife, Treva, daughter, Nicole, sister, Andy Lund, Quinn, and nephews. To read his full obituary online, go to hhlohmeyer.com. Cards and condolences can be mailed to Andy Quinn. The address is 1248 18th Street Northwest in Cedar Rapids, 52405. In Cedar Rapids, Chester, known as Chet Thomas McGrath of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Dubuque, passed away at the age of 95 on Monday evening, March 18, at the Harmony Cedar Rapids. Bear's Funeral Home in Dubuque is assisting the family with arrangements. Chet's daughters will greet friends and family at Bear's, 1491 Main Street in Dubuque, on Friday, March 22nd, between 9:30 and 11 a.m. A private graveside service and burial will follow at St. Clement's Cemetery. The family would like to thank Chet's second family at Evergreen Estates, Harmony in Cedar Rapids, Mercy Medical Center, and the VA Clinic and Hospital for the care and compassion they provided in Chet's later years. For a complete obituary or to share a thought or memory, please visit bearfuneralhome.com. In San Marcos, California, Donald, known as Don Edward Wenger, age 77, passed away Sunday morning, March 10. Don was born to Clarence and Dorothy Wenger at Washington, Iowa Hospital, October 6, 1946, and grew up on a 280-acre family farm in rural Wayland, Iowa. He was taught the good work ethic by his parents working together as family and was surrounded by unconditional love. Service for Don will be at 3 p.m. on Saturday, March 16th at Magellan Chapel, 1421 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. The complete obituary can be found at www.silverliningcremations.com. And lastly, from Onslow, Doris N. West, age 87, passed away Monday, March 18, at the Anamosa Care Center. A funeral will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, March 23rd, at the Wyoming United Methodist Church. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, March 22nd, at Dawson Funeral Services in Wyoming. Burial will be at the South Mineral Cemetery. Doris Nelly was born July 13, 1936, in Clinton, Iowa, to Elmer and Dorothy Graybill Jess. She graduated from Miles High School and on February 9, 1957, was united in marriage to the love of her life, Darrell West, at the Methodist Church in Miles. Doris's family would like to extend a special thank you to the Anamosa Care Center for the care they gave Doris. Memorials may be directed to the family to be donated in her honor, and cards of condolences are to be directed to Dawson Funeral Services, P.O. Box 258 in Wyoming, Iowa, 52362. Turning now to the sports page, it's track season. This story, Boys in Under Boys Track and Field, is titled Iowa City West Wants the Whole Thing, and this is written by Jeff Linder. On the backstretch of the track, on a cold afternoon earlier this week, the seeds of relay excellence were being sown. In lanes 5 through 8, sprinters blasted out of the blocks four at a time. In lane 4, it was one relay exchange after another. For the Iowa City West boys track and field team, both are an everyday occurrence. Starts and handoffs. We work a lot on our handoffs, Coach T.J. Craig said. You can win a state title in a relay with above-average sprinters with good handoffs. Of course, it helps when you have good sprinters. Craig has them, And last year, the Trojans had elite relays, 4x100, 4x200, distance medley, and shuttle hurdle on its way to a Class 4A fifth-place team finish at the state meet. "You'd think winning four relays, we would have finished higher than fifth," Craig said. "We're going to utilize the guys this year the best way to get a trophy. If it's through relays, it's through relays. Most likely it will be through three stars, seniors Aiden Jacobson and Isaiah Lovelace and junior Mustafa Tia. It would be nice to win some relays again," said Tia, a middle distance specialist. "It would be better to bring a trophy home." Of the 62 points West accumulated at state last year, 48 and a fourth are back for 2024. Only Ankeny returns with more points among 4A contenders. "Our goal is to win the whole thing," said Lovelace, who will continue his track career next year at Indian Hills Community College. "I've wanted that since my freshman year." Lovelace was on three of those gold-winning relay teams and was the 200-meter runner-up. "I'm way faster now," he said. "I can tell through our tempo workouts. I'm more explosive. I can get my legs moving even more." Jacobson bypassed his senior basketball season to stay healthy for track. "I didn't want the shin splints and the whatnot," he said. What he does want is the state record in the 400-meter hurdles, and that's 50.96. He ran 52.46 last season in a 4A runner-up effort, sailed nearly 23 feet in the long jump, and ran on a pair of winning relays. "Other than Christian Janis, most of our relay guys are coming back, and we're faster than last year," Jacobson said. Tia anchored West's distance medley to gold last year and was third in the 800. "He is a threat in any race from 400 meters to 3200. "I don't want to be a one-trick pony," he said. "Whether I run the 800, the 1600, distance medley, 4x8 or 4x4, it comes down to coach. My favorite of the event is the one he puts me in." West's roster consists of 130 athletes. "It's huge that we get the support of our football staff in getting kids out," Craig said. "We have a lot of young kids that are hungry. A lot of kids make a big jump between their freshman and sophomore seasons." Turning now to the Things to Do column in the literary category, Grace M. Cho's work sits at the crossroads of creative nonfiction and interdisciplinary scholarship, exploring the ways in which residues of state violence and historical trauma permeate the intimate spaces of the here and now. That takes place at the Iowa City Public Library, 7 to 8:30 p.m., and it's called Local Libraries Lit, featuring Grace M. Cho. In the comedy category, Joe Gatto hosts a popular comedy podcast called Two Cool Moms on the iHeartRadio podcast, where he and his co-host dispense sage motherly advice to fans who write in with their dilemmas. That's at the Riverside Casino today. Tickets there are $49 to $69, and that's from 8 to 9:30 p.m. And in the gardening category, pollinators need minerals, and with these easy steps presented by Linn County Master Gardener Lynn Tormey, you are invited to build your own little watering station haven. That's at the Ladd Library, 3750 Williams Boulevard in Cedar Rapids. That's presented from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. today, and that is free. Turning now to the Hoopla section, New Lessons in Old Czech School. This by Elijah Desius. A young pastry chef has stepped out on her own for the first time to turn the former Czech school into a cozy cafe for breakfast, lunch, and baked specialties. A graduate of Kirkwood Community College's pastry chef program, Kaylee Pliner came up through Cobble Hill before opening Delia's Baked Goods in November. Fresh out of her formative training experiences with a few tricks up her sleeve, owner Pliner, age 21, said it's an opportunity she's been aspiring to since she was a child. "It's something I've always wanted to do, I've been down at the farmers' markets in the summers, and I couldn't see myself going into another kitchen and working under someone, Pliner said. My brain needed to learn more, and the only way I was going to learn more was by throwing myself out on a limb. At the forefront of the shop's counter is its case with the seasonal rotation of sweets and staples, ranging from decorated sugar cookies and coffee cake to cinnamon rolls and macaroons, not to be confused with coconut macaroons. A base of complex macaroon flavors, Pliner's pride and joy, anchors the case with a few flavors. A green shamrock shake flavor kept time with St. Patrick's Day, next to chai macaroons. Moving into the summer, the case will soon transition into new items like fresh fruit tarts and citrus-oriented treats like a dreamsicle bar. The macaroons, influenced by her time at the high-end Cobble Hill, are something she perfected in her late teens and early 20s after trying throughout her childhood. Talents like coffee cake, a recipe of her grandmother's, and two varieties of cookies will always be available. In the Cedar Rapids area, I feel like every coffee shop around here has its own quirks. I just wanted to find a different groove, said Pliner, a Dubuque native. I've always liked the rustic vibe from scratch. I tell people, if it's going to be a cinnamon roll, I want it to taste like grandma's. A few bookshelves, tables, and a swing chair in the corner help curate that atmosphere. But the owner's heart and soul, as she calls it, lies in her artisan bread. With sourdough, bagels, pita, and brioche, she showcases her personal talent through a tailored menu of simple but wholesome sandwiches for breakfast or lunch. Soon she hopes to offer a perfected rye bread. It's very therapeutic to me. It always has been, she said. Taste her sourdough or bagel egg sandwiches customized with a variety of veggies and sauces. Or her sandwiches like grilled cheese, hot ham and cheese, roast beef with roasted peppers and pepperjack cheese, or avocado and caprese toast. Quinoa bowls with protein and vegetables, capping the menu's modest pricing at $10, are another option. To drink, the similarly focused beverage menu features energy drink infusions in fruity flavors, fresh fruit smoothies, espresso-based coffee drinks, and teas. Delia's Baked Goods brings new life to a spot that has been vacant for years. The building was constructed in 1901 to educate a bustling population of Czech immigrants in what is today called the Czech Village and the New Bohemia District. In 1951, building repairs and waning attendance led to the school's closure and sale to Andrew Polina, who with his partner, Bob Capone, remodeled it into a sausage factory. Polina retired and sold the business in 1970. Marshall Godwin briefly ran the short-lived Czech School Deli in 2011. Pliner hopes the cafe brings a new presence to the community. Yes, I'm hopeful our food will be amazing, but I'm hoping to get out into the community and have an impact, she said. A cookie will always put a smile on anyone's face. In brief, if you go, it is Delia's Baked Goods, located at 999 2nd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Hours are 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, closed on Sunday. Grab one of several wholesome grilled sandwiches, fresh artisan bread, cookies and specialties like macaroons, alongside an assortment of fresh fruit smoothies, espresso-based coffee, drinks, or tea. Here are a few other items under the What's Happening column. Maple Syrup Fest at Indian Creek. Savor the flavor of handcrafted maple syrup fresh from the tap and stay for family fun at Indian Creek Nature Center, 5300 Otis Road, Southeast. The 41st Annual Maple Syrup Festival, held from 8 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday, features syrup-making demonstrations, a look inside the maple sugar house, and a pancake and sausage breakfast with real maple syrup, handcrafted at the Nature Center. Tickets are adults, $10 in advance or $12 at the door. Ages 4 to 12, $5 in advance or $6 at the door. Ages 3 and under are free. You can find information at the Indian Creek Nature Center website. In Swisher, St. Joseph's Day Dance. Time to trade the green of St. Patrick's Day for the red of St. Joseph's Day on Sunday. The Czech Heritage Foundation is celebrating St. Joseph's Feast Day with a dance to the music of Becky and the Ivanhoe Dutchman. That's from 1 to 5 p.m. on Sunday at Dancemore, 77 2nd Street Southeast in Swisher. Tickets are $10 at the door and free for ages 21 and under. The event also includes a 50-50 raffle and a bake sale. Profits support the Czech Heritage Foundation of Iowa's educational projects and programs. For details, go to CzechVillageCedarRapids.com. And in Cedar Rapids, explore egg decorating with the Nedgel family from 6 to 9 p.m. on Friday and 9 a.m. to noon and 1 to 4 Saturday at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. Participants will learn how to decorate eggs using the traditional batik wax resist method. The process involves several stages of tracing designs with wax and dipping the egg in different colored dyes. Each student will leave with one finished egg. Class size is limited to 15 participants, ages 8 and older, and children ages 8 to 11 must be accompanied by an adult. Pre-registration is required, and the cost is $35 for members or $50 for non-members. That does include your materials. In Marion, Swamp Fox Bookstore is sponsoring a conversation with Heather Gudenkauf, New York Times bestselling author, at 6 p.m. on Tuesday at the Marion Public Library, 1101 6th Avenue. Gudenkauf's 10th thriller, Everyone is Watching, releases that day. A Cedar Rapids resident who grew up in Iowa, Gudenkauf will be in conversation with Laura McHugh, internationally best-selling, award-winning author of several novels that explore the dark side of the Midwest. The event is free and open to the public, and a limited quantity of Everyone is Watching will be available for purchase and signing at the event. Swamp Fox Bookstore has moved to 1375 7th Avenue Suite A in Marion. A grand opening will be held April 27th, which is Independent Bookstore Day. The store also will present New York Times best-selling author Jennifer Chiaverini on May 15th at the Marion Public Library. Cedar Rapids is looking for a high today of 45 and a low of 32. Chance of rain or snow shows up in the forecast for tomorrow. The normal high for today is 49 degrees, and the normal low is 29. We set a record high of 85 degrees in 1938, a record low of 1 in 1960. Sunset tonight is at 7:21 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow at 7:06 a.m. That gives us 12 hours and 14 minutes of daylight. And we're in the waxing gibbous moon phase with moon rise at 3:57 p.m. and set at 6:18 a.m. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today on IRIS. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great, safe day. Thank you.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.